it's Tuesday, November 12th. Lucky you, you're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arnison and producer Ken Barnes. So as many of you know, I rent to law students in my house because the law school at UNH Law does not have a dorm. And this morning at about 8 o'clock or 8:15, I get this knock, Arnie, it's snowing. It's my student from Pakistan. So cute. And I'm looking out and going, well, it's a couple of flakes. You know, it's really more rain than snow. But anyway, yeah, I said, yes, it is, Tusky. It is. So, I mean, again, we were just talking about how remarkable it is that I get to live with students from all over the world. And then through Airbnb, I get to sort of meet people from all over the world. And it really is, you get to delight in their awe.
Right, that's really
what I'm doing. I'm delighting
exactly,
in their awe.
Exactly. And it tells you something funny. I had my son. We adopted him when we were very old, my wife and I. And people, friends of ours, told us we were out of our minds because you're too old, you'll get exhausted and blah, 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 and you won't be able to keep him under control, all this other stuff. And I said, I see it the exact opposite. It's going to just give me more energy. It'll keep me younger.
Exactly.
I'll view the world through the eyes of
him.
A newcomer. And, oh, look at this. Isn't this interesting? And, I've taken it for granted for how many decades. And the same thing with, you're living with these people.
Exactly.
Who,
and they keep
you
younger.
Oh, my goodness, snow. Well, in New Hampshire, we sort of don't get too excited about it.
Especially when I saw four flakes and 12,000 pounds of rain. Anyway, it was so charming. It was just so nice. So anyway, I had to share that little vignette because, again, those are the little details that you don't want to forget. You know what I mean? You don't want to forget because it is something very lovely.
Right.
And I remember when my new son-in-law brought me a Chinese hot pot to make Chinese hot pot food. Oh, my God. I think we ate forever. Every kind of spicy dish and every kind of vegetable and mushrooms I didn't even know the names of. And, oh, my God. I mean, it's just all those things that are just so much fun. All right. On this Tuesday, November 12th, sir, what is exciting you other than tomorrow the public hearings begin, which is just all you hear on cable news 24/7, which is why we're not doing it today, just to let you know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good. I have said that I wanted to talk about what's going on in Great Britain
with Brexit.
In past things. And every time, or not every time, but a lot of those times, it's been about Brexit. Today it isn't.
Okay.
I want to talk about something else that's going on in Great Britain.
Let me see if I can. No, I have no idea. Go on.
You won't.
Okay, good.
A rabbi.
Okay,
was
I never would
arrested,
have gotten there. A rabbi was arrested.
Arrested
for?
In London.
Yeah.
During the Extinction Rebellion protests.
Okay.
Saying protest is a moral duty.
Good for him.
Rabbi Emeritus of Finchley Reformed Synagogue. Finchley.
Of course, Reformed Synagogue.
Jeffrey Newman was accompanied by around 30 Jewish activists. Mm-hmm. He was arrested after kneeling and praying in the middle of the road as part of the Extinction Rebellion protests in London.
Wow.
30 Jewish activists were all arrested in the middle of a busy junction. They lay down in the street in front of those big double-decker red English buses in central London. And they were obstructing the whole Extinction Rebellion was obstructing five roads since 7 o'clock
five
in the morning.
Roads.
Five roads. They had 1,400 people arrested during a week of protests. So
they're
really out there. Right. And I think it makes a huge difference, not just a huge statement, but a huge difference to have all these people out there blocking streets.
Right.
You know, you write a letter to your congressperson and it doesn't get quite that much visibility. Yeah. The world sees that this is outrageous. And here is this 77-year-old rabbi. Here's a picture, Arnie. I know
where I love him. There's little prayer shawl.
There's this little old guy,
with
gray hair. He's shriveled up, like your grandfather.
Yeah.
And he's on his knees and his hands are covering his face. He's got a huge prayer shawl, talis on, and a yarmulke. And behind him is a big protest banner.
Yeah.
And holding up the banner, there are people in hijabs and people of color and everything else
climate
in front
change.
Of this little old rabbi.
Right.
It is just really something to behold. And, you don't see it too much in our country. The 77-year-old who was wearing a white kippah, which is yarmulke, skull cap, branded with the Black Extinction Rebellion logo.
God, I love it.
Said, quote, "I see it as my religious and moral duty to stand up for what I believe in and what I care about for my grandchildren."
Yeah. So, you know,
isn't that great?
It's his
moral duty.
This is what
Jewish values, Christian values, Muslim values, this is what American values are all about. You believe something, you stand up for it, you express your view, right, and you try to change what you think is going to destroy the planet.
So I come of two minds to the whole thing about the climate crisis. It obviously can completely undermine anything in the way of community, and people can sort of see each other as the enemy. Or we can all suddenly realize we're on this planet together, and it can bring us together to realize that if we work together, there is a way for us to survive this, to maybe rehabilitate this. And you see that with what you're just describing now going on in London. And I think that's the hope I have. And I want to work towards that so people can see that that kind of energy is successful, and the energy of despair and hate and fear is not a success strategy.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
that's why I'm bringing this up. It is so important, because many of us, people who are really active politically, who have been active politically, they wring their hands and, oh, my God, what are we going to do? We've got to, you know, hope that the country and the planet survive until Trump's out of office.
Right.
So listen to this, Arnie. Here's another thing that this rabbi said, quote, "I haven't tried to involve my synagogue in this because if you're asking for permission, you might not get it."
He's right. He's right. He's exactly. Well, you know, this is so. I'm gonna bring this back. I'm gonna personalize this. But I keep thinking, when I had Kirsten as a baby and I brought her to the legislature, I never asked permission. Can I bring her every day?
Yeah.
I just assumed I was, and I probably would not have gotten permission if I had asked. So I thought, why bother? Skip that. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And he goes on. I think it's much more important to do what I'm doing.
Yes.
And they can approve it or not approve it at a later date.
Yes, exactly. Well, before
isn't that great?
It's great. Then did you see you don't do Facebook, but I posted this on Facebook, and I thought of you as I posted it. It's from jewishcurrents.org. I posted this yesterday. Ready? Here's the title: How to Fight Anti-Semitism. Who wrote it? Bernie Sanders.
Wow.
You should read it. I'll send it to you. I posted it.
It's,
and here's the coolest part. So how did I find it? So I was looking through my Twitter feed, and Sebastian, who joined us, Sean Sebastian from Iowa,
who happens
to be from India. His family's originally from India.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he's an incredible activist, incredibly articulate. He read it and posted it and said, it's really quite remarkable. And so the thing about this, I had to go to Iowa for Sean to sort of find it so I can find it to post it in New Hampshire. Again, these are the kinds of positive threads that we need to share with each other, just the way you did that about the climate crisis. I love it.
Yeah, it's very important.
All right, everyone. So there was a couple of things that I did today. Actually, speaking of climate crisis, this is incredible. I always have an aside. So I posted what we're going to be talking about today. In our first part, we're going to be talking about sex workers in Houston. It is such a depressing story. It is such a depressing story. And I saw it at Slate.com, and I thought I would grab Roxana to join us. And then we're going to be joined by John Nichols of The Nation magazine. And I do have to tell you that I called him this morning because we had a cancellation. And when I called him this morning, I said, so, John, what do you want to talk about? And he said, oh, easy, Arnie, two words. I said, really, what are they? Billionaires suck. I said, yeah, we can do that. Anyway. But you just heard Ken talking about sort of our obligation to sort of step forward when we are concerned about the future of our planet or the future of our children, and that, you know, the idea of getting arrested should not frighten us, and the idea that protest is an important thing. So as I'm thinking about reasons to protest, I saw this story in the New York Times from about 2 days ago. And here is the title of the piece: EPA to Limit Science Used to Write Public Health Rules. Can I just repeat that headline? I want to make sure that you absorb every word. This is the Environmental Protection Agency. Remember this, EPA. EPA to limit science used to write public health rules. I read this article. I was so upset. I've linked it on my Facebook page for The Attitude, so you really should read it. And as I just framed the article for the aside before we get to our first guest, I wrote, Trump administration relies on no facts and no science. Well, at least they're consistent. I just so love it. All right. As many of you know, we like Slate.com a lot. We talked to Mark Joseph Stern. What is his name?
Mark Joseph Stern.
Okay, Mark Joseph Stern on a fairly regular basis. And we go to it. And yesterday, I saw an article at Slate.com that was sort of intriguing for a couple of reasons. One, it was about sex workers. And I'm always exhausted whenever I read anything about sex workers because I never see anything in the way of a positive resolution. I just see it demonizing. I see it harming everyone, including the community. And every kind of approach seems to end in failure. And sure enough, the one I read at Slate exactly did the same thing. But the other reason I also glommed on to the article about sex workers is, as many of my audience knows, we air early in the morning on KPFT in Houston, Texas. And so because of Scott Braddock, who is the voice of Texas, and because of our airing on that Houston station, we have actually spending a lot of time covering a lot of issues in Texas, and we have learned a tremendous amount. And frankly, let's be honest here, everyone, as Texas goes, so goes the country. So the title of the piece was, Houston Tries to Banish Sex Workers. Sometimes you have to go after the people. Apparently that's the angle. Roxana, is it Asgarian? Is that how you pronounce your last name?
Yeah. Asgarian
is an independent journalist based in Houston, Texas. And Roxana, this story, I know they came up with a novel idea. I'm not quite sure if anybody else has really tried it, but I think it flamed out and wasn't incredibly successful. So set the stage for what are the concerns of the chief of police, the mayor, the community about the specific area in Houston and why they thought this new and novel approach, which you can explain to my audience, might in fact work. And then looking at it sort of going forward, success doesn't seem to be the name of the game here.
Right. Sure. So this is an area of Houston. It's called the Bissonnette Track, and it's a little triangle that's bounded by a couple Houston freeways and then this Bissonnette Street, which is a main thoroughfare in Houston. And it's known, some say internationally, as Houston's sort of hub of prostitution.
It's red light district, right?
Yes, red light district. So this is street sex work that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And many people in the community feel that it's overly pervasive, that, you know, there's an elementary school in the area, and there's thousands of crime reports every year, and many of them are prostitution related. Mm-hmm. And so I think the people in the area are just frustrated. Mm-hmm. And the HPD, Houston Police Department, has been down there and, you know, obviously very busy down there. But the county attorney, which is separate from the district attorney, and they decided to take a novel approach, and that was to file suit against individuals in the area known as sex workers or, in some cases, buyers or pimps. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to sue them in civil court to the aim was to, if they're caught doing prostitution-related activities, that they would be fined and or given jail time.
So let me understand something. So there's like two tracks here. There's the criminal track, and then there's the civil track. And my understanding from your piece is that the rationale for the civil track is that they were looking at the behavior of the sex workers and their pimps and perhaps even their clients as kind of a nuisance. Is that what I understood?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. And it's novel in that nuisance laws are typically used to target businesses. So right. This would be like the bar that serves underage patrons, mm-hmm. In this case, in the specific area, the nuisance laws have been used to target businesses like hourly motels
right.
that are, places where the sex work takes place.
Right. So this is a novel approach. And one of the things I read, and I want to sort of go to the end and then we'll come back again and sort of go through this rest of the article. But part of the frustration, I think, for people like the mayor and the county attorney and the chief of police is that obviously people are concerned about this behavior. They're seeing that, you know, it's not being addressed. So sometimes what is not uncommon is that you would rather do something than do nothing, even if what you do has never really been tested. turns out not to work, but at least it's saying to the community, we hear you, we're mm-hmm. trying this too. I feel like they're throwing spaghetti against the wall. You know, it's
yes.
like it's like okay, I'll try this now. Or will you be happy? And I was reading a lot of the comments on your piece, Roxana, at Slate. And one of the things that I keep thinking is maybe criminal or civil has never worked. And at what point in time do we begin to realize that maybe there's some value to legalizing this behavior, since if nothing else, it, you know, people are harmed, people are targeted, people are vulnerable. You're not protecting sex workers. One of the women that is in your piece ends up dead. I mean, it's mm-hmm. sort of like, okay, I don't think this strategy is working, and I'm not sure it's ever worked.
Yes. Totally. And I think exactly what you said, it shows the community that they're trying something.
Exactly.
But it doesn't necessarily, it has been tried, something like this has been tried
Milwaukee.
One other time. Yeah, in Milwaukee. And the city attorney there said it pretty unequivocally, it didn't work in Milwaukee.
So tell me why it didn't work. What were the outcomes? I know they publicized people's names, and that created a greater sense of vulnerability. What else did they try to do? They also tried to obviously find them. We just did a piece last week about the fact that who really gets hurt by a fine? The only people that get hurt by the fine are poor people. You know, so you're already in a lot of ways setting them up to fail because you know they can't pay it to start.
Right. You know, fines for, I mean, no one is doing street sex work if not for the money, you know, so they're obviously in need of money. And the fines, you know, for a middle class person might be a difficult nuisance. But for people in poverty, it can, you know, and if you don't pay the fines, you can end up in jail.
So, exactly.
But, you know, the other piece that made it hard in Milwaukee was that it was just impossible to enforce because you're asking police departments who are already tasked with criminal problems, right? Mm-hmm. So their focus is on crimes, to also add this additional thing. And in Houston, it's asking for specific behaviors to be limited. So that's like, for instance, waving mm-hmm. or sitting at a bus stop or being on a cell phone. And these are things that are subjective, possibly, and that leads to concerns from the ACLU of Texas that that police could potentially discriminate in their enforcement of this.
So I want to read this to some people. This is incredible. So some of the things that they were basically deciding people should not do was that they could wave, they could wait at bus stops, they could be associating with specific people. And people are like, now how could this not lead to discriminatory policing? I mean, it's like, can you imagine? So you look like a harlot. Therefore, you wave and we're going to stop you. But if Arnie, who's dressed in a little business suit, is waving, oh, she's fine. I mean, come on. It just seems obvious on his face that when you start suggesting that there's a problem with waving, you really are in deep doo-doo.
Yeah. And there's definitely, the fact that it potentially violates these people's rights has been raised. And, the suit actually hasn't taken effect. It's going to be, there's going to be a trial on it next February. Mm-hmm. So it may or may not go into effect. And if it does, the women's names will be, again, made public. And that led to concerns from both anti-trafficking groups and also sex workers' rights groups, which, they very rarely agree, but they both agree that this is that this suit would be harmful and not helpful, not achieve the aim that they're hoping for.
So,
Roxana, was there any discussion among the policymakers or the public about maybe targeting, I know they wanted to go after the people, not the businesses, instead of going after the women. How about going after the Johns? I'll tell you something, if you publicize their names, I'll bet that might actually have a deterrent effect.
Yeah, so some buyers are actually included in the list of names, and also a few pimps. And those, sex workers' rights groups are actually a little bit worried about that too, because the idea that it would be a deterrent, these people claim that might be a deterrent for some of the less dangerous people, but not for some of the more dangerous buyers.
Oh, God. So the idea of using the concept of nuisance, that's kind of scary, too, because it seems it's so, how do I say it? It's so speculative. Like, what is a nuisance? You know what I mean? It's like I know what usually criminal activity is fairly precise. The problem with the term nuisance is that it really is in the eye of the beholder and that it lends mm-hmm. itself to such abuse. And I think that's what's so scary about this movement towards nuisance, because it's empowering police to do things that historically you wanted to limit their ability to exercise certain kinds of judgment.
Yes, definitely. And it opens up the question of, you know, if some people can be considered nuisances, what other types of people might down the line be considered nuisances?
So has Houston had a public conversation about legalization? I mean, again, if you look at your comments, I'd say probably at least 70% of them kind of said, like, why aren't we legalizing it? Why aren't we requiring them to have medical exams? Why aren't we? That mm-hmm. way, there's a level of protection that is important. And therefore, I mean, not that you will always have people that break the law. Look at our president. But at the same time, I would just think that if they were able to try this and then it turns out next year that the court finds it unsuccessful, have you talked to the mayor, have you talked to the chief of police about having another public conversation in Houston that, look, we've tried this, we've tried that, we've tried this, and at least you can show the public there has been an attempt, but every attempt has not succeeded, and to some extent, maybe it's even failed more gloriously than what was going on before. Maybe we need to have a totally different approach.
Yeah. You know, in some ways, I think Houston is behind the curve on this. I know yeah. other cities like New York and D.C. are having a conversation about decriminalization and, right. and what that would look like. And, you know, there's a lot of ins and outs to that, and people have really strong opinions about it. But I think in Houston, that conversation hasn't really happened yet. Yeah. And I think this lawsuit shows that the mindset here is still one of criminalization. I mean, they're basically coming up with new and novel ways to further criminalize sex workers.
Well, you know, I think in a lot of ways, maybe it's time has come, though, because what we're seeing now with marijuana and what we're seeing about how we realize that, you know, that war was a war that we were not winning, and it was incredibly unsuccessful. And again, there's also, and this is the part that really just kills me, is that, you know, I know a lot of people that smoked dope. Most of them never went to jail. Most of them were never picked up, and even cops stopped them. Why do we know that? They were driving BMWs. They were driving Volvos. They lived in nice neighborhoods, and they were white. And then I can talk right. to the same group of people, only they may not be driving a BMW or a Volvo. They may be living in a place like Roxbury or whatever. And they did get picked up, and they did have the book thrown at them. And I'm thinking this is – I mean, and it's so obvious, and we saw it especially when it came to smoking dope. And when it comes to sex workers, I probably can tell you what couple of people I know that are bankers, you know,
yeah.
who've used prostitutes, but they don't get into trouble, you know, and they don't get arrested. And I'm thinking, if these are behaviors that we find in all walks of life, whether you're wealthy or poor, then maybe we need to step back and say, okay, what do we need to do to provide some level of protection and also, more importantly, some level of fairness and justice? And I think that's yeah. really what your article points out, is that this was so wildly unsuccessful, and it really did target people, and it targeted people on what they looked like.
Yes.
You know? Oh, my God, Roxanne. Well, keep us posted, and when it goes to trial next year, you'll have to write another article.
Yes, for sure, I will. Thank you so much for having
me. All right, you're welcome. So, you know, Ken, you've been an attorney. You are an attorney. You look at all these things. It just makes me crazy. I go back to when we were talking about legalizing marijuana in Massachusetts, and my good friend who was a lawyer there, you know, basically what was so ironic was there wasn't one public official that supported it, not one, including public officials who talked about their smoking when they were in college and in law school and how they were like, how wrong they were. And I'm thinking, and you didn't get arrested. Just look at the difference. I mean, that was their defense. You know, their logic was, well, I didn't. I realized how wrong it was.
They said they realized how wrong it was, because there are probably plenty of legislators and bankers and lawyers who are still smoking.
Oh, of course. But it was just, there was an irony here about how they didn't want to legalize it, and yet they were at least honest enough to say they had done it. Mm. And I'm thinking, but look at why you are not in a situation where, you know, you aren't in jail or you have a criminal record. It's because of the color of your skin. It was because of your zip code. It was because of where you went to school. It wasn't anything to do with your behavior.
Right.
Nothing to do with your behavior.
Right. So did they finally realize that when you brought it to their attention?
No, of course not. But which is why it had to pass in every single community, because it went by referendum. I mean, that was what was so amazing. I think every single community passed it except for maybe two in Massachusetts when they first did the first decrim bill. Can you imagine? And yet every single public official came out against it. You know, and who are they protecting, these public officials? That was my question. I never quite got to know. All right, everyone.
They're rich donors.
Who the heck knows? And on that note, we're going to do a little labor history next. But when we come back to The Attitude, John Nichols of The Nation magazine, I called him. There's so much on our plate. Obviously, billionaires was because of Bloomberg and Bezos and Tom Steyer, who, by the way, Tom Steyer today is filing his paperwork to run for president. I believe that Michael Bloomberg has until the 15th if he chooses to file in New Hampshire.
Friday, the
15th, exactly. Mm-hmm. My understanding is he wants to skip New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada, and Iowa, because that's the little people's primary. You see, when you're rich, you can go into the super primaries and just buy it, is what I think his rationale is.
Yeah, of course, that man is not thinking about how it's going to look to skip all the primaries and compete where everybody else is. He's like Rosie, whatever that woman's name is, who ran out at the end of the New York Marathon or Boston Marathon, crossed the finish line first.
Right, exactly.
And I'm skipping the rest of the race.
Exactly. What's 18 more miles? You guys can run it. All right, everyone, a little labor history, and then when we come back to The Attitude, will be John Nichols of The Nation. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day Ellis Island closed its doors. More than 12 million immigrants had passed through its gates since it opened in 1892. Those steerage and third-class passengers coming to America were processed at the island between 1892 and 1924. They were routinely subject to medical inspections to determine they were free of disease. Legal inspections included questions regarding birth, occupation, destination, finances, and criminal record. The busiest year was 1907, with more than 1 million arriving to enter the United States. During World War I, the island was used as a detention center for presumed enemies and those considered foreign-born subversives. After Congress passed the Restrictive Immigration Act of 1924, arrivals entering the country slowed to a trickle. Then Ellis Island became primarily a detention and deportation center. During World War II, thousands of Germans, Italians, and Japanese made up the majority of those detained awaiting deportation. It also served as a military hospital for returning servicemen and training center for the Coast Guard. By 1950, Ellis Island served as a holding center for arriving communists and fascists who were prevented entrance under the recently passed Internal Security Act. A Norwegian seaman who had overstayed his leave was released the day the island closed and told to catch the next ship back to Norway. In 1965, President Johnson made Ellis Island part of the National Park Service. A massive restoration of the island began in 1984, organized by Lee Iacocca's Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation. It reopened as the Ellis Island Immigration Museum in 1990, featuring numerous exhibits, publicly accessible immigration records, and the award-winning film documentary Island of Hope, Island of Tears. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. To avoid the worst consequences of global warming, the world urgently needs to cut carbon pollution. But cutting pollution from the world's energy system takes time, so some suggest that we also need to consider geoengineering the climate to cool it down. But this drastic approach is very controversial, so first we must understand the potential consequences. For example, one idea is to spray small particles into the atmosphere to block some sunlight from reaching the Earth.
That will certainly cool down the planet. It doesn't address the cause of climate change, but it can cool down the planet.
Frank Koich is a professor of engineering and atmospheric science at Harvard University. To help scientists better evaluate this approach, Koich and his team plan to send a balloon into the atmosphere. it will release a tiny amount of mineral dust. The team will study how the particles disperse and how they interact with one another and the atmosphere around them. The experiment is so small that it will have no impact on the global climate. But Koich hopes it will provide information that can lead to more informed discussions about so-called solar geoengineering.
We should look at all possible options that we can have in our climate change response toolbox.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I want to talk about the rich and the super rich, the poor and the super poor. Come on, come on, come on, come on, let's talk about it, talk about it, talk about it, talk about it.
You say about it, you say it, come on, you tell them, come on, you tell them.
The people who live on the hill.
I don't want to stop. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Of course, what are you listening to? You listen to The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Who picks our music? Ken Barnes. So who sings that, Ken?
That's the old OJs.
Whoa. I tell you.
The rich get richer.
It's the perfect backdrop for our next conversation. So let me set this up. So I had a guest, and my guest, here's the good news. My guest at about midnight sends me an email and says, I can't make it to the show, Arnie. My kid's sick. And of course, John Nichols, who I called at like 8 o'clock in the morning, because I needed to replace this guest, said, well, he could talk to you, Arnie, while he's home with the kid. And I'm thinking, no, it'll be too much pressure for him and too much pressure for me. But I called John and I said, so John Nichols of The Nation magazine, who I totally adore, what do you want to talk about? Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, simple, Arnie, two words, billionaires suck. And I went, well, that's perfect. So that's exactly how I set it up, John, on my Facebook page when I sent it out. But I thought, just to texturize the conversation so it's not just a snarky comment, I thought I would share two headlines with you. One of the headlines was, richest 1% in U.S. will soon have more money than the entire middle class. And if that doesn't make you feel bad, let me make you feel really bad. Millennials earn 20% less than boomers did at their age, despite more education. Oh, John Nichols, I tell you, I think we need to buy these billboards. I think this is, if the economy is doing so well, explain these headlines. Thank you. Anyway, welcome to the program.
It is a pleasure to be with you. And I just want to say, I don't mind being snarky about billionaires.
I'm sure you don't.
At all. It gives me immense pleasure.
Well,
I would go so far as to say that if I was a billionaire, I'd probably still be snarky about.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of them actually. And now, did I actually hear this, that Zuckerberg said that Warren was right about her wealth tax and the idea that, you know, about the control of the billionaires? I just thought it was like, really? Did someone script that line for you?
Because that's the weird thing. And we got much deeper things to go to, but I will remind you that even billionaires who appear to be nice guys or women, because there are a few women billionaires, though it's a disproportionately, tends to still be a disproportionately male thing. But even billionaires who are, you know, kind of public and humane and decent, I think they basically know That the way the power structure works in this country, it's unlikely they're really going to get dinged. And so sometimes they'll say, oh, yeah, for sure, I favor, a little more taxing of billionaires. Well, I just want to clarify here up front. I favor a lot more taxes.
I had a feeling you were going there. Well, I wrote something when I was posting this on Facebook. I wrote something that in a lot of ways I feel like the billionaires have are about to complete the trifecta. And the trifecta is that one about the 1% now controlling virtually more wealth than the entire middle class and upper middle class. But that the other part of the trifecta we know is that since money is speech and we've seen how they control through the revolving door on the regular state, that they basically now control Congress, and they've controlled, most of the regulations that we see happening, whether it's, through banking and Mary Jo White with the SEC. I mean, it just sort of makes me crazy. But now they also want to basically control the White House. So what they've done is that it really is a trifecta. We own you, we have the wealth, and we might as well have the title. Being a billionaire is not enough. We like the idea of president, despot, king. And that's what's missing, because CEO just doesn't do it for them. So I just feel like that's kind of the direction we're going in, and it just feels so, so frightening.
So bad.
Yeah.
No, look, here's the thing. The first thing we've got to understand is that the skills that might make you a billionaire have absolutely nothing, zero, to do with the skills that would make you a good president. And the notion that somebody who is able to accumulate a lot of money is thus able to govern a nation effectively, participate in the governance of a nation of 300 and some million, and to essentially assume the role of kind of a first among equals among world leaders. That's absurd. It's ridiculous. Because, of course, what the primary skill that most billionaires, not all, mind you, do you know what the primary skill that most billionaires have?
No, what?
Choosing the right parents.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
It's inherited wealth, or and it may be that they built something huge up themselves, but they started, the easiest way to become a millionaire is to have millionaire parents, right?
Right.
And the easiest way to become a billionaire is to have multimillionaire parents, or at least people who can give you a lot of advantages up front. Now that's, that is what it is, but that doesn't in any sense give you the skills to be president. Inheritance, be it economic or political, is not the way this is supposed to work. Because if it was, by the way, George W. Bush would have been a brilliant president. He inherited the skills from his father.
Yeah.
And so political inheritance isn't a good thing, but economic inheritance isn't either. We were founded by a group of people, very imperfect in many ways, but the best of their bunch. Tom Paine said the reason you wanted to get rid of a hereditary monarchy and, by the way, hereditary economic power was because it dumbed things down. You took people who, you might have somebody strong in one generation, but the next generation could be a mess.
Right, right.
Blah, blah, blah. So the bottom line is we have to start to break out of the pattern of thinking that because someone, had a luck of birth, that necessarily means that they're ready to govern. And it's especially the case as regards the luck of economic birth.
Yeah. Well, as I'm thinking about it, I go back to 2016 and about Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
And the billionaires were not nervous because everybody assumed Hillary would win. And even though Bernie was wildly successful coming out of a tiny state the size of a suburb, being a democratic socialist, talking about all those ideas that everyone had poo-pooed, and obviously they did resonate with a base, I think people never thought that it would sort of gain traction. But instead of it sort of disappearing, in part because Hillary did lose to someone like a Donald Trump, not only did I think Bernie sort of unleash this sort of progressive vision of so many Democrats that basically had been there and been brewing under the surface, but were basically slapped down by the Democratic National Committee or by the Democratic Party or the New Democrats or whatever we're going to call them. You know, all of a sudden it was like someone saying, see, the sky is blue. You can actually talk about it. And then we're seeing what happened in 2018, where again, even where and this, I think, is so important, John, even where a lot of moderate Democrats won, when you look at what happened in the primaries brought out a lot of a very progressive base. And even if the progressive candidate didn't succeed in the primary, that base continued to show up in the general election. So that they needed each other. They couldn't survive. Those moderate Democrats needed those progressives to inspire and encourage and motivate people to sort of enter into exercising the franchise. And when we're looking right now at what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are talking about, and it really has unleashed a level of fear in the very wealthy that you never would have seen if it was a Hillary Clinton or a Joe Biden or a Mayor Pete, in part because, you know, they understand that they need to massage the billionaires. And Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are asking, why do they exist? And I think that's what's so frightening for them.
And I think you're starting to get a distinction here where Sanders seems to be asking a little more aggressively even than Warren.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, this is where you start to have it. That's a debate I want to have, right?
Yes, exactly.
The debate between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on how aggressively you go after billionaires.
Exactly.
That's a beginning point, by the way, not just for what would make me happy. That's the beginning point in any functional democracy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You wouldn't have a debate, you know, where you start on the range of billionaires should be able to do whatever they want, you know, mm-hmm. over to, well, maybe we should regulate them a little. You push all that stuff aside. You begin at maybe we should regulate them a lot. And then the other end of the debate ought to be, maybe they shouldn't exist.
Wow.
Right? Maybe you just shouldn't have billionaires because nobody should be able to accumulate that much wealth.
So, John, you're saying that Bernie's more aggressive than Elizabeth at pushing these points, but why is it then that Elizabeth's the one that's taking all the heat, much more than Bernie is?
Absolutely right. That's absolutely right.
Could it have something to do with her gender? Sure, of course. I mean, it probably some. We haven't done very well as a country in that regard. But let me suggest that it might also be something else as well. Elizabeth Warren has moved up to something of a front-runner status. I mean, the polls have generally put her up. Sanders has had an incredible resurgence in the last few weeks, and he's moved up well. But he's not in that, you know, he's not kind of in that top point. And I will be very blunt with you. Our media system is by and large run by people, not the reporters on the ground always, but sometimes, but you know, more often than people at the higher levels, who it isn't just that they might oppose the idea of having a democratic socialist president. They can't wrap their head around it. It's beyond their comprehension.
Right.
And so covering Sanders seriously is something that our media doesn't do.
And they don't.
Okay.
You can actually say they don't cover him. He doesn't get the FaceTime on CNN or MSNBC or ABC. None of it. It's like even when he's leading, that's not the headline. The headline will be something else. It is kind. You're absolutely right. They don't know how to cover him. Mm. So as a result, they don't. And that's both a disservice to their learning skill as well as a disservice to the people to understand what Bernie is actually doing.
And it's also a disservice to Elizabeth Warren. Right?
Yes, it is.
Because here you have two candidates. And by the way, you put their numbers together, right?
Right.
If you put the numbers that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are getting in most of the primary and caucus states, and then at the national level, they are clearly the front runner, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This combination of the two. And yet, because the media chooses not to cover Bernie Sanders seriously or much at all, Warren ends up getting all the heat, a lot of the heat for it.
Right.
And I think she's quite capable of taking it and pushing back. So, you know, and there are certain advantages to getting attention, all of that. But in a media system that actually, you know, was serious about covering politics, which I know that's dramatically too much to ask for. But in a media system that was serious about covering politics, you know, Bernie would be taking heat on this too. There'd be a, you know, both of them would be, you know, targets, and that's more that Warren gets it at this point.
Can I ask a question, John? And that is that I don't know why we can't have a conversation with the American people and say, so let's go back to 1970 and let's go to 2019. And what we know is we have a hell of a lot more billionaires. We know that most of the income that we saw coming into the economy was not shared in any way, shape, or form, but basically sort of all moved to the top. And if you want to go back to the good old days, whatever that means, then maybe we should start asking the question, well, in the good old days, we didn't have that many billionaires. Having that many billionaires ain't good for you. Having that many billionaires isn't good for affordable housing. It isn't good for healthcare. It isn't good for infrastructure. It isn't good for job creation. They got these wicked tax cuts. All they did was buy their own stock back, and they didn't. They, in fact, invested less in capital development. And so if nothing else, you can say to them, if having billionaires was good for you, then nobody would give a crap. But having so many billionaires meant that that money, instead of it going into the betterment of the nation and the community and the states and your livelihoods, it went to them. And that's where it's wrong. If it could have seen your boat lift, nobody would be bitching and moaning. But your boat had to sink for them to succeed.
I agree with everything you said, although I'd probably still be moaning because I got a thing against billionaires that goes deeper even than fairness.
Okay.
You know, I genuinely am in the Tom Paine school. I believe that the simple accumulation of wealth, even if it isn't harmful to everybody else, it creates an elite class that we focus on too much, we become too obsessed with.
Yes.
And do you like the Beatles, by the way?
Do I like the Beatles? Sure.
Yeah, you like them? I like them, okay.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So when you listen to the radio, would you like to listen to the Beatles all the time?
No.
No. It would be, you like to hear, get the OJs.
Exactly.
Right?
I hear you.
And so we live in a culture right now where even if the unfairness of the calculus wasn't there, we're so obsessed with billionaires. We are so obsessed with the super rich. We are so obsessed with this, you know, incredibly elite lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a radical change for our country. Do you realize that in the 1930s, 1940s, a huge portion of our literature and a huge portion of our cinema at that time, radio programs as well, it was sort of like, you know, it's always the scrappy working class person,
right,
who, you know, didn't. George Bailey was the hero of, right, It's a Wonderful Life, not the banker, not, you know, Mr. Potter,
not
right?
The banker. And, no, that's right. That's
and
right.
Now we're all like, everything's like these, you know, kind of, you know, rich people living these incredible lives, right? And even when I was a child, right, you turn into CBS, it was Beverly Hillbillies. So they got rich, but they still didn't know how to use it, which was encouraging. And then they would always go back to Hooterville or back you know, wherever in the mountains and be hanging out with, you know, really working class people.
Yeah.
Or at least relative, you know, comedically working class people, but still. And we're just not there anymore. And I will tell you this, that's unhealthy for a republic. And so when we happen to be now in a political debate, and it is about how tough we get on billionaires, the debate ranges, you know, all over the places you've already discussed. But now we get into this, you know, there's sort of this weird intersection, which is, I think, at the heart of the matter of what we're talking about. And that is, not only do we have billionaires taking all the wealth, taking too much of the wealth, overwhelming the rest of people just on that economic level, we also have this place where, you know, because of this respect we have given them, this immense level of unwarranted respect, they're now considered serious potential candidates for president of the United States.
Well,
we have a faux billionaire president now.
Yeah, faux billionaire.
Probably never really did it.
No, I agree.
But then we have another billionaire running for president, and we've got another billionaire in the wings.
But there's something else wrong with being this wildly successful, is that they're immune from prosecution. And that's the one thing I've been talking about a lot. So, you know, Bloomberg is obviously thinking about running for president. And he wants to skip the first four primaries and caucuses because that's the little people. Because he has so much money, he doesn't need to worry about being in the debates. Frankly, the idea of being in the debates is a weakness for him, not an asset. Because
you've never seen him debate, by the way.
But more importantly, because he can buy anything. What did he spend? $102 per vote the third time he ran for mayor in New York. You know, I mean, it's like an unbelievable amount of money that he can invest without even feeling it because he's at least $53 billion. So he can do this. And so in a lot of ways, I feel like we're the little people's primary. You know, this is for the riffraff. He knows exactly what he wants to do. He doesn't need to sort of play on the same playing field as everybody else. But the other thing that really sort of scares me about the Bloombergs is that when you look at his time as mayor, I think the greatest thing that is the most offensive is the similarity between him and Donald Trump. And one of the things that Bloomberg did in his second term was realize that there was this financial crisis and that New York absolutely needed him because he was the only answer, because that's what happens when you're a billionaire. You assume you have all the answers. He was able to basically buy his third term, even though there was term limits, you know, and you kind of go, oh, my God. And Donald Trump has to look at Bloomberg going, you know, how did he do that? Because I'm thinking he's looking at, you know, I mean, we keep talking about Nikki Haley in 2024. And I wanted to tweet out Nikki, maybe 2028. You know, I said, because you think he's leaving. I don't think he's leaving even if he's losing in 2020. And you think he's leaving in 2024. And again, there is this assumption that the rules are not for them. And that is the part that makes me so afraid. Whether you see criminal prosecutions, whether you see what happened. How did Donald Trump get away with what Donald Trump got away with in New York City for decades, other than the fact that his affluence and the illusion of affluence is what protected him? Anybody else would have been in jail.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it's also, we can reverse this order a little bit and say a lot of billionaires, the way they made their money would put them in jail, right?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's like it isn't just what they do once they've got it.
Including Trump, by the way.
Right.
Yeah, there you go. And so, but let's just pause for a second because we want to keep people in the reality-based world here. So you had that figure of Bloomberg spending $102 a vote.
Right.
In fact, I think that's a very low estimate because remember, he spent immense amounts of money, not just in his campaigns, but to fund a referendum to get rid of term limits and
to
promote constantly. So, I mean, it was probably a lot more, but let's take that figure, right?
Yeah.
Then if we've got about 100, you know, I figure out how many people vote in a regular election in this country, about 130, maybe we have a bump turnout next time, 150 million people,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That's, if Bloomberg were to actually be the nominee and get half of that. First off, you got to go through primary and all that. You know, you really would be talking about this guy spending in the range of, you know, $8, $9, $10 billion.
And he could
to get elected. Well, of course he could do it. Yeah, I understand that. But understand this. Bob Mucchesi and I, a few years back, we actually did the only that I know of serious study of what was spent. And this is the 2012 election. We looked at all the spending at state, local, federal referendums, mm-hmm. et cetera. We came to about $10 billion mm-hmm. in a presidential election, you know, allowing for inflation.
But that was
everything.
Goes
up.
Right.
That was everything. For every office sounded like dog catcher, right?
Right.
You're talking now, you know, 8 years after that, just an 8-year period after that, one guy spending what everybody else spent for every office.
It's right.
And that's fiercely anti-democratic.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that is, I mean, again, I go back to, I want to sort of scream at the Citizens United decision. And I keep thinking that when they made the decision that money is speech, we're screwed. Mm-hmm. Because now, it's like with the rise of the billionaires, then we have no voice. None.
But I also want to emphasize, it's not just Citizens United.
No,
I mean, Citizens United is important, but you understand, do you know where this goes back to?
Buckley v. Vallejo,
1976, where you let rich people spend what they want.
Right.
And here's the interesting thing. When did that decision come? We're coming full circle here, brother and sister. When did that decision come? 2 years after Richard Nixon was forced to leave the White House.
Right.
because of a financially based scandal. Remember, Watergate had, you know, it wasn't just, you know, breaking into the Watergate building. It was, you know, suitcases full of money and all sorts of stuff like that. And so in 1974, in that period, we implemented campaign finance reforms. Mm. 2 years later, they were stolen from us by the rich.
Right.
And this is the important thing to understand. The rich are never going to fix our system.
No.
Because it worked really well for
them. Exactly. And yeah. And I'm going to end this conversation, John, with the question I've been saying over and over again. I remember when Hillary Clinton was running for president the second time, and she had spent that, you know, 15 months making $21 million talking to, you know, all these very influential Wall Street financial houses. And then she began her campaign. And the question I always want to ask Hillary, because at that point in time, she and Bill were the richest ex-presidents. And I want to ask the question, when are you rich enough? And I think that is really a question that we have to start posing. When are you rich enough?
And the answer is
never.
Never, because, you know, you would say, well, $10 billion would be enough. But it's not if you want to buy the presidency.
Exactly. And on that note, John Nichols writes for The Nation magazine. He is an absolute charm for saying yes. Thank you so much. And we'll think about Mayor Bloomberg on the 15th when he doesn't sign up for the New Hampshire primary going, oh, well, tisk, tisk. Anyway, talk to you soon, Joe. Bye-bye.
Such a pleasure. Take care.
Bye-bye. And we end with?
We end with corporate greed, the anthem.
Oh, of course. That's exactly what it is. Here we go.
Republican or Democrat, the labels just don't matter. When our government's for sale and served up on a silver platter, with corporations influencing all our legislation, don't you think it's about time we push for stricter regulation? We want to be free from corporate greed. We need to get out from under their thumb. We want to be free from corporate greed. Right now might be the hour for the people to take back their power. Our politicians cater to the richest 1%, while the rest of us can't figure where their bailout money went. The banks enjoy protections of their personal rights, but if they're the ones...